Once again, this is Dr. Phil Fernandez, founder of the Institute of Biblical Defense and the academic dean of Fariston Theological Seminary. Today's lecture is lecture number 8, World Religions, lecture number 8, Secular Humanism, part 2. Secular Humanism, part 2, World Religions, lecture number 8. Now, in our last lecture, we discussed Humanist Manifestos 1 and 2, written in 1933 and 1973, and we stated that these give us the basic teachings of secular humanism. We define secular humanism as the worldview that either God does not exist or he is a non-issue in the affairs of men, and that man is the ultimate value in the universe. We stated that secular humanism is a religion, and we discussed some of the signers of the Humanist Manifestos 1 and 2. Then we discussed some of their basic beliefs, their belief in atheism, that there is no God, their belief in evolution, that life gradually evolved from non-life, and their belief in socialism as the best form of government, heading in the direction of communism and away from private ownership and the sharing of everything, which in actuality just does not work. You've got to leave enough capital in the hands of businesses to create jobs for workers, and that's why the free enterprise system works and socialism does not. They teach that traditional religion is harmful, that there's no evidence for belief in the supernatural, no divine purpose for mankind. They teach that only man can save this planet, that heaven and hell are harmful illusions. They deny life after death, and they teach that traditional religions like Christianity and Judaism hinder human progress. They teach that ethics are autonomous and situational. In other words, that each one decides what is right for themselves. They teach the right to abortion and divorce should be recognized. They teach that the freedom to pursue one's own sexual lifestyle, so long as it is between consenting adults, should be protected. They teach that educating children in sexual freedom should be done, and that euthanasia and the right to suicide should be protected. That people are more important than rules, and that the state should not favor any particular religion, even though they want their particular religion protected. They teach that a world community is the answer to our problems. They teach that they want an end of war and the reduction of military spending. They want international courts to settle disputes. But the question comes up, can courts stop violence? Does it not take a military to enforce the rulings of a court? And they teach the ending of poverty by distributing the wealth, which is more than socialism, it is communism. And they teach the toleration of all views, except, of course, traditional religions. And so that's the teaching, some of the basic teachings of secular humanism. And now let's discuss the problems of secular humanism. Number one, the view that atheism is true. That needs to be questioned. Atheism has been an ultimate failure. When a man says he has experienced God and therefore believes that God exists, he may possibly be true. But when a man says, I haven't experienced God, therefore God does not exist, that's a leap of blind faith right there, because the only way for a man to know for sure that God does not exist would be if this man himself is all-knowing and is everywhere present and has been able to see not only on the physical realm but even the spiritual realm in order to prove that God doesn't exist. In other words, atheism, the belief that there is no God, can never be proved. In fact, there is good evidence for God's existence. And because there's good evidence for God's existence, the God of the Bible says in Psalm 14:1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. If you deny God's existence, the Bible calls you a fool. The Bible also teaches in Psalm 19:1, King David says, the heaven declares the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hands. In other words, when we look to the beauty of the heavens, we can see that God is our creator. Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 22 reads this: For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. And so the Bible once again calls the atheist, or anyone who believes, denies the God, the existence of the God of the Bible, or rejects the God of the Bible calls them a fool. The Bible states that though we have not seen the invisible God, we have seen the work, the visible work of his hands. Though I haven't seen the carpenter who built this room, I know he must exist because I see the work of the carpenter's hands. And so it is very clear the scriptures teach that God's existence is very clear. There is good evidence for God's existence. I'll give a very quick, very simple argument for God's existence. William Lane Craig's argument, his cosmological argument for God's existence, goes as follows. Everything that has a beginning needs a cause. The universe has a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. Now, everything that has a beginning needs a cause is very clear, because if something has a beginning, it could not cause its own beginning, because then it would have to pre-exist its own beginning in order to cause its own beginning. So whatever has a beginning could not cause itself to exist. Whatever has a beginning could not evolve from nothing. You see, nothing couldn't cause something to come into existence, because nothing is nothing, nothing does nothing, and nothing causes nothing. Therefore, if something had a beginning, if something came into existence, since it couldn't cause its own existence, since it's absurd to pre-exist your own existence, since it couldn't cause its own existence, and since it couldn't evolve from nothing, then that tells us that something had to cause it to come into existence. So everything that has a beginning needs a cause. Then William Lane Craig shows both scientifically and philosophically that the universe has a beginning. First, with the Big Bang Theory, shows us that the universe, the elements of the universe, are getting further and further apart. It has much of the effects that are, its effects are similar to that of an explosion. So that you, if you went back further in time, if you went back further and further into the past, the elements of the universe would get closer and closer together, until scientists state that you reach a point of either dimensionless space or infinite density. Now, something can only be finitely dense or finitely small. To be infinitely small or infinitely dense means to be nothing. For space to exist, space has to have dimensions. If it's dimensionless, it takes up no space at all. So dimensionless space is just another scientific way to say nothing. You see, scientists don't want to come right out and say the Big Bang Theory teaches that the universe came into existence from nothing. Because to state that, then the next assumption we must make is that, well, then something else had to exist besides the universe to bring it into existence out of nothing. Because from nothing, nothing comes. And so the Big Bang Theory teaches that the universe had a beginning at a point in time, that it's not eternal, that there was a time when it did not exist, and that there was a time when the universe was nothing, and then all of a sudden it was something, it exploded into existence. Also, William Lane Craig points out the second law of thermodynamics, energy deterioration. Now, the first law of thermodynamics, energy conservation, teaches that the amount of energy in the universe remains constant. That's energy conservation, the first law of thermodynamics. But the second law of thermodynamics is energy deterioration. That teaches that even though the amount of energy in the universe remains constant, the amount of usable energy is decreasing. In other words, when energy changes forms, the amount of energy that is usable decreases. This tells us that the universe is winding down. It is going to have an end. If it's winding down, it means that it had to have been wound up. If it's going to have an end, it means that it had to have a beginning. And if it had a beginning, it means that it had to have a cause. Then William Lane Craig presents philosophical evidence for the beginning of the universe. The universe is one of space, time, and matter. And when you look at the element of time, it tells us that there has to be one event in time following another event in time following another event in time. But William Lane Craig shows that for the universe to be eternal, there would have to be an infinite or unlimited set. There would have to be an unlimited set of finite time events. In other words, you would never reach a first event, because no matter how far back you go, you can just keep going back further and further infinitely. Well, William Lane Craig shows that if we had two sets, the set of all odd and even numbers starting with 1, it'd be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, odd and on infinitely, that would be an infinite set. But if you had another set with just the even numbers, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, on infinitely, that set would also be infinite. So both sets would be equal because they'd be infinite. Yet, the even set only contains half of the numbers that are contained in the other infinite set, because the other infinite set has both odd and even numbers. So you have both sets being infinite. They're both equal because they're infinite, but they're also unequal because one is twice the size of the other. Now that violates the law of non-contradiction, which states that A cannot equal non-A in the same way at the same time. And so what this tells us, you can have a hypothetical infinite set of finites, but you cannot have an infinite set, an actual infinite set of finites. You can hypothetically have an infinite set of numbers, hypothetical numbers, but you can't have an actual infinite set of pens or infinite set of baseballs. And so because of this, we can see that the universe, since it's impossible to have an actual infinite set of finites, that's what the universe would be. It's impossible for the universe to be infinite. Therefore, the universe had to have a beginning in time. Whether you look at it scientifically or philosophically, atheism fails, because everything that has a beginning needs a cause. The universe has a beginning. Therefore, the universe needs a cause. And supposing the cause of the universe needs a cause, you can't go back and back forever, because again, you would have an actual infinite set of finite cause and effects. That's impossible. So eventually you have to arrive at a cause that is eternal. And once you arrive at an eternal cause for the universe, you need to bend the knee to it and worship it. And so those who argue that atheism has been proven, that is not the case. Atheism is believed by a leap of blind faith. There is good, solid philosophical and scientific evidence against atheism. Atheism is a failure. Number two, evolution is not a proven fact. Evolution is not a proven fact. In fact, evolution contradicts much of what science has proven. Evolution contradicts much of what science has proven. Number one, some of the major problems with evolution: energy conservation, the first law of thermodynamics. The amount of energy in the universe is constant. No energy is now being created or destroyed. Therefore, whatever brought the universe into existence is no longer in operation today. This is what the Bible means when the Bible said that God rested from his creation work on the seventh day. If evolution was true, you'd expect new energy to be created on a regular basis. The second law of thermodynamics, and scientific laws are as close to a scientific fact as science can come. Energy deterioration, the second law of thermodynamics, teaches us that the amount of usable energy in the universe is running down. So the energy deterioration teaches that the universe will have an end because it had to have a beginning. And therefore the universe, which is called nature, needs a supernatural cause. The Big Bang Theory and the expansion of the universe also confirms the beginning of the universe. So the energy conservation and energy deterioration, the first and second laws of thermodynamics, are major problems with evolution. Also, evolutionary dating methods are inconsistent and unreliable. They're based on the principle of uniformitarianism, which assumes that there's been no worldwide catastrophes. It assumes a constant rate of decay. Yet no one knows. No one was in the past to say, lived in the past to say if was there when God created the universe, if he in fact did. What if there was a worldwide flood, like the Bible said? Then the uniform dating principles would be false. You see, it's like if you had two books on a shelf and they both had as much dust on them, you could assume that they were both there just as long. But one of them might have been there twice as long, it's just that somebody came in and dusted it off halfway through. And then your dating methods would be shot. Rocks known to be only a few hundred years old have been dated to be hundreds of millions of years old. So there's problems with evolutionary dating methods. In fact, Dr. Henry Morris, the founder of the Institute for Creation Research, has stated that there's many different ways to date the Earth's age. Many different ways to date the Earth's age. But evolutionists only use those methods which give astronomically old dates, since evolution needs millions of years even to seem slightly possible. Dr. Henry Morris, basically, I'm paraphrasing what he says, there's many different ways to date the Earth's age, but evolutionists only use those methods which give astronomically old dates, since evolution needs millions of years even to seem slightly possible. Some methods, in fact, point to a very young Earth. Population statistics, moon dust, the Earth's magnetic field, right on down the line. Now, the fossil record is a problem with evolution. It's assumed to prove evolution, yet it shows no evidence of missing links. New life forms appear suddenly and fully developed. You don't find half fins, and you don't find half wings. In fact, since fossilization is extremely rare today, and since fossils are caused by rapid burial, this could point to a worldwide flood, which is exactly what a worldwide flood would do, would cause worldwide fossilization. Another problem with evolution, which is what secular humanists assume, is they think that mutations prove evolution. In actuality, they don't prove evolution. Evolution needs new genes in the genetic code. Instead, mutations only alter already existing genes. See, they evolutionists who teaches that single-celled animals evolved into humans, the question comes up, where did single-celled animals get genes for teeth? Now, when you're an embryo, a single-celled embryo in your mother's womb, you have genes for teeth, you have genes for hair, the color hair you're going to have, the color eyes you're going to have. But with a single-celled animal, you have none of those genes. Another problem with evolution is that there's no evidence for missing links. No evidence for missing links. Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon man have been shown to have features of modern man. The Colorado man has been shown to be a member of the horse family. Java man has been shown to be a large gibbon. Heidelberg man only consisted of a lower jaw. God only knows what he was. Piltdown man was a clever hoax. Peking man was a large monkey or a baboon. Southern ape was an extinct ape. So was Ramapithecus. The East African man was an ape. Dryopithecus was an extinct ape. Then there's the Nebraska man from the 1925 evolution trial. A tooth was presented as evidence for the missing link between apes and men. But 2 years later, the tooth was proven to be the tooth of an extinct pig. And so there's no evidence for missing links. Even Archaeopteryx, thought once to be the missing link between reptiles and birds, has been shown to be classified as a bird now. In fact, many evolutionists hold to what Stephen Jay Gould calls punctuated equilibrium. See, it's been 125 years since Darwin, still there are no missing links. And so punctuated equilibrium says, well, we found no missing links because there are none. Basically, evolution doesn't happen slowly. It happens so quick that you don't see the difference between the species. Now, they won't admit it, but what this teaches is that two apes had a baby boy, and many baby boys and baby girls were born about the same time, and that these mutations started the human species. Now, since evolution means gradual change, punctuated equilibrium talks of sudden changes, has not evolution been abandoned? Punctuated equilibrium attempts to explain away the lack of evidence for evolution rather than dealing with the evidence itself. In fact, there's many unproven assumptions with evolution. There's no evidence for spontaneous generation, that's life, spontaneously arriving from non-life. It violates the cell theory and it violates the law of biogenesis. The law of biogenesis teaches that all life comes from prior life forms. The universe is not eternal. The universe couldn't evolve from nothing. There's no proof for intelligence coming from non-intelligence, for multi-celled animals coming from single-celled animals, for animals with backbones coming from animals without backbones, and there's no evidence for common ancestry between fish, reptiles, birds, and mammals, because common anatomy can point to common design easier, a common designer easier than it would point to common ancestry. In short, there is no evidence for evolution. So secular humanism is easily refuted because atheism is a leap of blind faith against the evidence, and evolution has no evidence for it. And so once you remove those two, secular humanism goes right down the tubes. Also, they claim to believe in autonomy, but then they forbid rape and incest. That's a contradiction. They have contradictory views. Because they claim to believe in autonomy. They say, what's right for you is right for me. It doesn't have to be right for me, and vice versa. But then they say, thou shalt not rape, thou shalt not commit incest. They go on to say, thou shalt not be against a worldwide government. Thou shalt not forbid people to have abortions. And whenever you say, thou shalt not, you're contradicting the belief in autonomy. They need to either reject their belief in autonomy and admit that they're dogmatic, or they need to uphold autonomy and then allow every person to do whatever they want. Another problem with secular humanism, they forbid the state to favor any religion, but then they want their values taught in school. They forbid the state, secular humanists forbid the state to favor any religion, but then they want their values taught in school. Secular humanists also fail to see that some rules help people. They talk about rules as if they're so negative, but they need to see that some rules do help people, such as speed limit rules, such as the Bible condemning homosexuality. If we didn't have gay marches and gay bars on every street corner, if we didn't allow homosexuals the freedom to find their partners so easily, the AIDS epidemic would not have spread so quickly. It was 1973 where the psychological community in this country, for the first time, agreed that homosexuality was not sinful, nor was it a mental disorder, but it was simply an alternative lifestyle. When that decision was made in 1978, we had our first AIDS case. We didn't discover that it was AIDS until 3 years later, but it took only 5 years from the day that we began to look with favor upon homosexuality. It only took 5 years from that point before we went right down the tubes with the AIDS epidemic. Another problem with secular humanism, they fail to see the dangers of a one-world community. They fail to see the dangers of a one-world community. Look at Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13. I'm talking about the Antichrist. Revelation chapter 13 and verse 7 says, "And it was given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him." So then the Antichrist rules the entire world. Revelation 13, verses 16 to 18. "And he causes all, the small and the great and the rich and the poor and the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. And he provides that no one should be able to buy or to sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. And so we're going to have the Antichrist ruling the world in the last times, in the end days, a one-world government that's supposed to bring on peace. When everyone says peace and safety, then destruction will come, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 tells us. We've got prophets going around like the secular humanists, stating what Ezekiel talked about, prophets going around saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. You see, the problem is not nuclear weapons. The problem is not strong militaries. The problem is in the heart of man. Man is bad. Man is evil by nature. And because of it, we need separate nations to protect one another. The Bible teaches that the best possible government man could have is a one-world government with a perfect ruler. And we'll get that when Jesus Christ returns. But the Bible teaches until that point, the worst government we can have is a one-world government ruled by a less than perfect man. And we're going to have that when the Antichrist, the demonic man, rules the earth. Until that point, the best government we can have now is separate nations. And with nations that recognize the inherent sinfulness in man, and therefore set up a system of checks and balances and a system of separation of powers, so no one man's sinfulness is able to suppress the masses. So they fail to see the dangers of a one-world community. A one-world government which is supposed to give us world peace, according to the Bible, more than one out of every two people on the planet Earth is going to die because of wars, starvation, famines. It's only going to increase the problems. So they fail to see the dangers of a one-world government. They also fail to see that violence is an internal problem and that only Jesus can end war. They fail to see that violence is an internal problem and only Jesus can end war. Look at Mark chapter 7, the Gospel of Mark. Chapter 7 and verse 15. And that reads, "There is nothing outside the man which going into him can defile him, but the things which proceed out of the man are what defile the man." In other words, the evil comes from within the man, from a man's heart. In fact, look at verses 20 to 23 in Matthew 7, in Mark 7. "And he was saying, that which proceeds out of the man is that what defiles the man. For from within, out of the heart of man, proceed the evil thoughts, fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries, deeds of coveting and wickedness, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, and foolishness. All these things proceed from within and defile the man." And so here we see very clearly that Jesus Christ taught that the problem comes from within the man, not from without. So violence is an internal problem with man, and therefore man isn't going to solve the problem. The best that we can do is to keep our own people protected. But to just rid the world, to say, well, we've evolved to the point we no longer need wars. Secular, before World War I, you had people with that type of thinking, evolutionists, saying that man has evolved and no longer will there be war. Then came World War I, which was supposed to be the war to end all wars. And then the secular humanists wrote in 1933, and they were real optimistic that we wouldn't need wars any longer. But then came World War II, and so Secular Humanist Manifesto number 2 had to be written later on. But we always think we're going to get away from this and that we don't need war. Daniel 9:26 tells us, even to the end there will be war. You don't have to go to the Bible to prove that getting rid of weapons is the way to go, is wrong. You don't have to go to the Bible to prove that. You can just prove that from history. There hasn't been a generation without wars. Why do we keep assuming that this next generation is going to be the generation? 1900, we said, well, this is the generation that there will be no more wars. World War I. Well, that was the war to end all wars. No more wars. World War II. Well, that was the war to end all wars. No more wars. Vietnam. The battle in Iran. And eventually World War III and Armageddon right around the corner. Isaiah 9:6 tells us, Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6 refers to Jesus Christ as the Prince of Peace. Secular humanists fail to see that violence is an internal problem. Only Jesus can end war and give us peace. Only Jesus can end war and give us peace. And then how he gives us peace is mentioned in Revelation chapter 19, verses 11 to 16, the second coming of Jesus Christ. Revelation chapter 19, verses 11 to 16. "And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. And he who sat upon it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and upon his head are many diadems. And he has a name written upon him which no one knows except himself. And he's clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. And from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may smite the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God, the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Jesus Christ will bring peace to earth by carrying a bigger stick than anybody else has got, and then by enforcing peace through his strength. The only way to get peace in a world of sinful men is for a perfect man to come, Jesus Christ, fully God, fully man, to carry a bigger stick than anyone else has got, and then to enforce peace through his strength. And so this blown up, exaggerated view of man, this warped view of man as being totally good, this view of secular humanism goes against all the evidence, whether historical or biblical. Also, their view that the distribution of wealth will end poverty is false. Look at John chapter 12. John chapter 12 and verse 8. This, by the way, is not an excuse to ignore the poor, but in John chapter 12 verse 8, Judas says, hey, this lady's taking expensive perfume to anoint you. She's wasting her money. She should have sold the perfume and taken the money and given it to the poor. But in John chapter 12 verse 8 it reads, for the poor you have always with you. For the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me. For the poor you always have with you. You see, you can't end poverty in this present system because of the fall, by the sweat of man's brow will he earn his food. By the sweat of his brow will he have to produce products from the ground to eat. By the sweat of his brow now that we're after the flood, he would have to go out and hunt down or raise animals to slaughter them for food. But, you know, you just can't walk up to a cow and take a bite out of the cow's side and eat it. Somebody's got to do some work. And if a man is too lazy to work, the Bible says in 2 Thessalonians 3:10, if any man will not work, neither let him eat. If a guy doesn't want to work and raise that cow and feed that cow and then eventually slaughter that cow and then cook that cow and then eat that cow, the man's going to starve. And so the distribution of wealth will not end poverty. If you took cows away from that butcher and distributed them among other people who are too lazy to slaughter the cows and cook them, they're going to starve to death. Distribution of wealth will not end poverty. In fact, my economy teacher, my economics teacher at college, my first year at Liberty University, stated that in America, if you took the wealthiest people in America and took all of their money and divided evenly among the remainder of the people, we would all be classified as poor. And so this idea that there's enough to go around, production is the key to prosperity. Getting people to work and to produce natural resources. You don't just walk up to a tree and find a steak hanging from it and just pull it off of it and eat it. Our resources are there, but they've got to be produced. They've got to be brought around to a condition that will feed us and clothe us. The distribution of wealth will not end poverty. The secular humanist claims to tolerate all views, yet they censor Christianity, and someday they may even persecute Christianity. But they claim to tolerate all views, but they cannot tolerate Christianity. You see, total toleration, the view all views will be tolerated, is just as dogmatic as Christianity is dogmatic. They need to recognize they're not tolerating all faiths. They're only tolerating faiths that claim to tolerate all faiths. And then any faith that claims to be a dogmatic faith, the secular humanists are dogmatically opposing them, which proves that they're dogmatic in themselves. And then finally, the final problem of secular humanism, they fail to see that man cannot live by bread alone. They fail to see that man cannot live by bread alone. Let me read to you what Jesus Christ said 2,000 years ago, Matthew 4 and verse 4. Matthew 4 and verse 4. But he answered and said, "It is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but in every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." And the secular humanists, they fail to see, they think all man needs is physical food. They think that man does not need his spiritual food to quench his spiritual thirst. And that's been a big misunderstanding. Now, what is the result of secular humanism? What is the result of secular humanism? Because secular humanism has been crammed down our throats in the public schools and through the media, through television, through the movies, through much literature, because secular humanism has been crammed down our throats, Americans feel a void for the spiritual realm. Americans feel a void for the spiritual realm. You see, Americans still feel a thirst for the supernatural. Americans still feel a thirst for the supernatural. Now, even though most Americans, 91% of Americans, still believe that God exists, that means they reject philosophical atheism, still most Americans have accepted practical atheism. In other words, they've accepted humanistic moral values. Most Americans rejected philosophical atheism. They still believe God exists. But they've accepted humanistic moral values, practical atheism. They live like God doesn't exist. So right now, the result of secular humanism upon America has been that Americans still seek spiritual experiences. Americans still seek spiritual experiences, yet they want a God that won't judge them. Americans still seek spiritual experiences. They're starving for these spiritual experiences, but they want a God that won't judge them. Enter Shirley MacLaine and the New Age movement. Americans are falling right into the hands of the New Age movement, a belief system where you can contact spiritual beings, disembodied spirits from people who've died in the past, get information from them, have them tell you that you're a god, we're all gods, we're all part of God, and then you can have your spiritual experiences that you're thirsting for, and you can have a God that won't judge you because you're your own God, so you can still have the spiritual experiences, but then do as you please. And so Americans are falling right into the hand of the New Age movement. The result of secular humanism, Americans feel a void for the spiritual realm. Americans still feel a thirst for the supernatural. Still, Americans have accepted humanistic moral values. Americans seek spiritual experiences and a God that won't judge them. And therefore, Americans are falling right into the hands of the New Age movement. You see, Western culture has gone from paganism, you know, before 300 AD, Western culture has gone from paganism to Christianity, then from Christianity to humanism, and now right back to paganism. Western culture is ending where it started, with a paganistic occultic society, as the New Age movement picks up, and that's what we'll discuss in the next two lectures, the New Age movement. Thank you, and God bless you.